Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday, January 19th meeting of the Education Finance Committee. Welcome everyone and thank you for joining us. For directions to the public and to members, remote hearings are held in accordance with Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents for today's meeting in their virtual packets available to them. And for the public, these materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they are attached to the calendar event that you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. If you're calling in and using your phone rather than the app function, text or email Ms. Burt to be recognized. If a member is on their all of this is the digital equivalent of getting the attention of the chair or the CA. Ms. Sunderland, please take the roll.
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sanstead.
Present.
Representative Kreisha.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damuth.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Jordan.
Here.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Thompson.
Present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
And Representative Joachim is excused today. That is the roll, and we do have a quorum present.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sunderland. Representative Sanstead, if you had the opportunity to review the minutes from Thursday, January 14th, and if so, would you please move them?
I have, and I so move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Sanstead. Are there any objections to moving the minutes from Thursday, January 14th? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes of Thursday, January 14th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, members. Members, this week we'll be continuing with a series of informational hearings, and we'll be hearing from state agencies and boards that fall within our jurisdiction. Today we'll hear from the Minnesota State Academies, the Board of School Administrators, the Perpich Center for the Arts Education, and the Professional Educators Licensing and Standards Board. Please, members, feel free to ask questions once the agency or board has concluded their presentation. First up, we'll hear from the Minnesota State Academies. Superintendent, Wilding, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, everyone. I will share my screen with you and my PowerPoint. Thank you for taking the time for me today. I'd like to share some information about our programs and our school. For some of you who may not know what our school is all about, then I will explain about our COVID applications and what we are planning for the next biennium. We have two campuses. We are in Faribault, Minnesota. We're about an hour south of Minneapolis. We have one school for the blind, and the services for the blind cover visually impaired and blind students. Some of them have also additional needs, and additional challenges as well that are included within their student. We have about 50 students on that campus. At the Deaf School campus, we also serve hard of hearing and deafblind students. Some of those students also go back and forth between both campuses as we see what fits them best for instructional methods, and we accommodate to fit their individual educational program needs or their IEPs. There are some specific needs and services that we need to achieve their education, and those may be accomplished on either campus. As I stated, we have two campuses. We have shared support services between those two campuses. They coordinate very well. We are very unique as we are a school that serves the entire state of Minnesota. We are not a local school district. We serve over 60 different school districts. They all come to our campus. We have a dorm facility on our campus for both the blind and the deaf. If they live quite a ways away, they come during the week and go home on Fridays. We give ongoing support. We also support local school districts that sometimes have needs, and we need to have referrals for evaluations. We assist with testing blind and visually impaired and deaf and hard of hearing students throughout the state. We work with a variety of organizations and agencies as Minnesota Department of Ed, State Services for the Blind, Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services. We have relationships with many other state agencies. We support the students and the families in an all-inclusive approach. I'm going to speak upon the deaf school. Some of the things that make us very unique. We start school at 18 months and go to age 21. The reason we start early is because many of our families, that is their first experience with a deaf person in their life. How do we communicate? How do we develop their language? How do we have them meet those benchmarks? Families are not sure on how to do that. So we provide in-home services to the family to instruct them on how to communicate with their child. And we also do group activities to develop that social language, communication, and knowledge base. And they begin creating peer relationships. At 18, when most high schools graduate, some of our students still need more time. They have learned their academic school skills, but they need some transition support. Under the IEP, they can continue to those services till they're age 21. So we have a wide range from 18 months up to age 21. There's a lot of information, curriculum, adaptations that fit the deaf and hard of hearing instruction and accessibility education. We use a lot of language support and communication, visual thinking skills. Often within that, those are often taken for granted in public school. This gives them clear instruction with their teachers and are able to have that ongoing support. We have ASL and English bilingual approach, so they're proficient in both languages once they graduate. Our older students, 18 to 21, we have an A+ program, academic plus program. They continue to work on transition skills, independent living skills, academic skills if they still need so, to enter the world of the workforce or off to college once they complete that program. That is the all-encompassing summary of our program. Now, moving on to the blind school's approach. The Minnesota State Academy for the Blind, communication access is very different compared to the deaf. We don't start at 18 months. We usually start at the normal kindergarten age of 5. We provide parents and groups workshops, exposure to early interventions, but the academic services typically start at age 5. And they continue to age 21 at this campus as well. We have different curriculum and instructions, and we focus a lot on the modifications and the materials that need to be adapted for accessibility. Many things out in the world are not accessible, to be honest. You can go onto the internet and look at different websites and social media. Many things are not accessible to our blind students. So as a duty for our school, we change our instructional materials so our students have full access. We have special software, Braille capabilities. We adapt and include more technology for communication tools. We also have an additional requirement for some of our physically challenged students as well. We look at different methods to access their learning and provide them with adequate education. Braille, orientation and mobility, expanded core curriculum, which is specific to the instruction of blind individuals to give them navigation tools and give them independent access to navigate through their world. We also have an A+ program at the blind school, Academic Plus. At the Minnesota State Academies, we believe in the whole child development, not only focusing on their academic skills, but we also want to take a look at the equal opportunity for anyone else at their age group. We encourage them to participate in different activities, learning experiences, life experiences. Oftentimes, when they are in their home district, their communication or accessibility is limited. They may not have the opportunities to experience different things in life. At our academy, we try to create opportunities, as many as possible, for our students to participate in those sports, music, drama, organizations and clubs, after-school programming. All of those are STEM activities, international studies, or just to name a few of the clubs that we have established. Our students are able to have what we call a functional equivalent to their home school district. They have access to their peers and as they would in public school. We want to see the whole child develop and graduate, be well-adjusted, independent, and living and learning, continuing on to school or into their workforce, whatever their dream may present. We want them to be productive citizens of America. We focus a lot on that, not only thinking, but we give opportunities that are provided to enrich the students' capabilities of learning in the real world. We also have a residential program. As I stated, about 40% of our students do live in the dorm during the week. 60% of our students are day students and commute back and forth on a daily basis. Within that population that stays on campus, we continue the learning into the evening. About 90% of our students happens outside of the classroom. So we need to make sure there's opportunities and activities into the evening for our students. We encourage tutoring support. There's academic support. We have activities for enrichment. We have a strong after-school program specialized in arts, STEM, field trips to museums, community service, volunteerism, that is all encompassing in our after-school programming. Also included is in sports and workshops for them to continue their daily learning. Here we provide 24/7 supervision. We have staff and support for the students during the day in the academic and in the evening, as well as overnight, to make sure our students are supervised, healthy, and kept safe. We have staff available to supervise if anything comes up. We also teach them independent skills on campus. That is a quick synopsis of our two campuses, and we teach 8 to 3, and we also continue our learning throughout the evening. So it's a little different than a regular school district. For us, we are different from the public schools as we receive our funding in a different way. Our allocation is strictly from the legislature. We do receive some district money for our aides and grants from MDE and federal funding, but we are not able to levy. 187 different sources of funding, as one school district presented last year. Really, I would say that 95% of our allocation comes from you. We do not qualify for many other grants as we are a state agency. We cannot levy, we cannot receive money for construction. We depend on the support from you as legislators. Our support, we would like to thank you for the continued support of our school. As I move on, I'd like to speak briefly, and I'm sure you have questions on how we have handled the COVID pandemic since last March. It's been a challenge for us. We've had to adapt very quickly, work very diligently, and many of our students require one-on-one support, whether that be in school or in the dorm. How do we provide that one-on-one support through distance learning? We had to set up a lot of technology and have the appropriate training for our staff and students on how to adapt. Our instructional methods changed from our very young littles to our very challenged students. Our teachers, our SEPAs, our aides, our support services, we have learned a lot since March. Our biggest challenge was to make sure that learning was accessible. Zoom cameras, sometimes the cameras were not a high enough quality to show the signing, so we had to send out different webcams. We had to look at the high-speed internet of all of our students. We had to make sure our students had the appropriate technology, internet access, laptops, webcams. On the blind side, some of our laptops were quite old and they weren't sufficient enough to understand the audio, so we also could not support the software. We had to adjust and get new iPads and laptops for some of our students. Our IT provided home support. Our aides provided tutoring in the evening. That was one of our hugest challenges. The adaptations that we have made to bring our students back on campus, we started in the fall, and our classroom setup, how we changed that, how do we social distance, but still keep visual access, providing masks and shields and making sure all the PPE is there, but we can still see the face expression. And deafblind students require close contact. How do we protect those students and staff? Are they able to hear through a mask at the blind school? We made many accommodations and tried to bring our best as we brought students back to campus. With distance learning, some of our deafblind students could not access it because they could not see. So we gave them special computer screens. We sent those home. Some students could not use a computer software at all. We changed to make Braille copies and books, and we sent those home. Our staff put on many miles to drive and drop off materials, some 4 to 5 hours, and do that on a weekly basis to get the materials for our students so logistically they could still continue their education. We looked at each individual need and adapted. Additional challenge, as you may know, that we faced in last May was with the George Floyd. Our administration decided to put a high emphasis on the discussion and learning and workshops and trainings with anti-bias and anti-racism approach. How we provide that information to our staff and how our staff provide that information to our students. We took a lot of consideration and our administration focused on diversity and how we support each student in their cultural and racial background. Many things have occurred that have been very positive. There's a lot of outside the box thinking and a lot of planning that has occurred. As we move forward into the next biennium, taking a look at what needs we have, we've requested four things. The first one is the annual appropriation as our budget needs. And costs are increasing. Health insurance, salary costs, needs for operations. We've asked for an increase in our baseline budget. We also have some positions that are IEP required. We must provide to our students. The IEP is very specific, and we can't deny services to our students because the design of their IEP fits that student's needs. We have some positions that are needed, and we must provide. According to state statute, we have to be a good resource for districts across the state. As I mentioned before, we serve all the districts throughout the state of Minnesota. As we take a look at how we can improve that support for those districts, we are looking for a position to provide that support to public school districts, to provide support to the students that are out there, to provide training and resources to those districts that we have not reached. Our board is taking a look and has voted for two new positions, and our legislature hopefully will support those two positions to meet our statewide requirement. Our third request looks at a change of statute language. We've asked for this in the past. In statute, we have one line that we are hoping that you will support, our rental income. We have people in the community that use our campus. We have meetings, trainings, events that occur on our campus. We would like to keep that rental income for our professional development for our staff. As I mentioned before, our students' needs are changing. We not only have deaf and hard of hearing and blind, but we also have many of them that have additional disabilities. Many of those requirements also need the professional development so our staff are adequately teaching those approaches. Our teachers are able to adjust to the students' needs with that continued professional development. 6 years ago, the legislation gave us a technology initiative to improve our technology on campus, to upgrade our one-on-one support devices, to upgrade our computer labs. We completed that, but as time, this is now our second phase. We have a mass communication system, similar to the schools that you grew up in, had an intercom system. We can't use an intercom system because our students are deaf and cannot hear that. We put in a visual communication system in our school buildings and one dorm. We completed that phase one. We have other buildings and other dorms that have not had that mass communication system completed. We are looking at phase two of installing that into the rest of our buildings, as well as our blind school, so the communication access can happen smoothly between both campuses. We are hoping for continued support to complete phase two, as well as upgrade and improve our technology. Technology changes very quickly, and our laptops and our iPads continue to also need to be updated. We are hoping that you find the funds for us to continue with our changes in supporting our students in that mass communication and technology. Like I stated, we do not have other sources for payment for our technology. We depend on your graciousness and support. Overall, that's what I would like to discuss. And as we move further into the legislative session, I'm sure there will be more questions. The governor will send out their budget and we will follow his recommendations as we see in the spring. If you have questions about the requests, I'm willing and available to show you or present more again if needed. I think that is a quick overview of our school programming and our students and our needs for the next biennium. I'm open to any questions at this time, or any thoughts that you would like to share.
Thank you very much, Superintendent, and Nettie, thank you to you for providing the translation services to make this available to all of us. Superintendent, I'm glad we were able to provide you with a shorter commute than past years to come before the committee. Are there any questions from members? Questions from members for Superintendent Wilding? Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Superintendent Wilding, for your presentation. I just want to mention a few little things. For the first time in Interstate 35 history, December 23rd, we got the Deaf and Blind Academy signs up. That was a wonderful, wonderful day. And I want to thank you and your staff for all the work that you guys do there. If you just quickly mention the reason we start children earlier at early ages at the deaf school compared to the blind school, I think that might be a good information for the public.
Excellent question, Representative Daniels. Thank you for it. Superintendent Wilding.
Thank you for the question. Language. For most of our language, we learn and acquisition up to age 5. For deaf children, often there is an absence of that access. There's no language until they arrive to school at 5. So they're very behind. They have a hard time catching up with their acquisition of language skills. So we try to shift earlier as much as possible to assist their families to attain that language. As I mentioned, many families do not know how to communicate or how to adjust their language support for a child that is deaf. And how do they hit those benchmarks for age appropriateness? The blind campus have that audio input. They may not be able to read and write, but they can still hear the language. So the language needs is a different approach compared to deafness and blindness. The early intervention is really critical. In US right now, the discussion is called language deprivation. Language deprivation doesn't mean that people intend to keep language from a child. It just means that often they are unaware. They don't realize that the communication for a student is not sufficient. The research is showing that when a student arrives to kindergarten, they should know about 50,000 words to communicate in different situations. A deaf child often arrives to school at age 5 with either no vocabulary or maybe up to 5,000. That is a huge gap that we're trying to close, and we do that by starting young at 18 months. To give them the understanding of what's happening in their surroundings.
Representative Daniels, any follow-up question?
No, not at this time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Wilding. It's so good to see you and to hear the report of the good work that you do at the academies. Do you have any idea how many millions you might need to take care of the operating budget and the other items that you've noted in your request?
Superintendent Wilding.
Right now we are waiting on the governor's final calculations, and we have sent a lot of information to the governor's office through our executive budget officer. It's in process of those calculations to get to those final numbers. We requested an addition in the baseline budget, and I believe it was close to $2 million increase for all four.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and to the Academy staff and Mr. Wilding. Thank you.
Superintendent, I see no other members with questions at this time. Again, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. Nettie, thank you for making it possible.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time today. And I hope to see you in person in the spring. Have a great week.
Members, next is Dr. Tony Kinkle, who's the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of School Administrators, and if memory serves, a former member of the body. Dr. Kinkle?
Dr. Kinkle, you need to unmute yourself.
Mr. Chairman, your memory is as good as always. Yeah, I served from 86 to 98, so pleasure to be with you. I know you're having Zoom fatigue, so I prepared a very, very brief presentation, and I think I'll be able to share my screen here. All right, let me pull up the. So we are the Board of School Administrators. And our board is a 10-member board appointed by the governor. And we work really hard with the governor to seek out the very best and brightest in all of these professions. And there are slots. So, for example, representing directors of special ed, Dr. Shaler from Rosemont, representing superintendents, Christine Osorio from North St. Paul, and et cetera. It's viewed in their profession as probably the highest honor they can do to serve on this board. So these are really outstanding folks. 30% of our board are people of color. 40 or 50%, depending on in Mankato, if you count that as a metro person or a greater Minnesota, Mankato has moved all of its administrative programs out of Mankato into its Edina site. So we tend to count that as a metro, but 40% of our board members are from greater Minnesota. We are overrepresented gender. 80% of our board are women, which is kind of interesting, but they all do a great job. And you can see the folks there that represent the different slots. We have one person who represents the public, Louise Sundin, who up until recently also served on the Minnesota State College and University Board. And representing school boards, you can see, is Jill Lofall from Duluth. She's the chair of the school board up there. So we do four things, and we try to stay in our lane, although the legislature tries to add things occasionally. You're asking us to gather data, which we wish we were better at. But primarily, we do four things. One, licensure. So we issue... there are about 7,000 licensed administrators in Minnesota. We do about 500 brand new licenses every year. About 30% of those come from out of state. Big, of course, as you can imagine, the big state is Wisconsin. Who wants to come into Minnesota? We do accreditation. There are 43 programs to prepare all these administrators. And by law, every 5 years, we go around and reaccredit. Now, we're pretty tough, to be honest, because this is a jury of your peers, if you will. In fact, we just refused to certify the University of Minnesota Duluth program 2 years ago. But we just did Bethel, just did St. Cloud State this year. We do all the ethics. We have a code of ethics as well as the statute that talks about immoral character or conduct of administrators. We're down to about 80 inquiries a year. It's typically 120, but with the pandemic, we have seen a reduction. in the amount of complaints, which is good. And finally, we have to approve, our board has to approve all the professional development that our administrators have to have. They have to do 125 clock hours every 5 years of approved professional development. So we review about 1,500 organizations, and they in turn award 15,000 official BOSA certificates. Now we collect, the legislature was gracious 2 years ago and allowed us to raise our fee. It used to be $75, we raised it to $100. We charge every active administrator $100 a year. We charge $50 a year for inactive administrators. Those tend to be folks who've gone back into teaching, they're out of administration, or they've retired, but they want to keep their license just in case. You can see there that we collect now more fees than our annual appropriation of $319,000, which I think is a good thing. When we estimated to MMB how many dollars we would raise with the new fees, we were very, very conservative on our estimates. We didn't want our budget premised on money that wasn't there. What's hard in estimating fees is we never know with these retired folks how many will actually pay the fee again. Sometimes they just decide that they're not going to do it anymore. So it's the science of projecting that is not perfect. And our fees go into the general fund, which in turn then helps for you to make our appropriation. Now, Sarah asked that I talk very briefly, and this is my last slide, about what we've done in the pandemic. And I don't need to tell you that, as you can imagine, your principals in your district, your superintendents, are getting beat up on all sides of this issue. And you all know that. You are interacting with parents every day on all sides of this issue. A couple of things we've tried to do in direction from the legislature, we did extend the deadline for them to renew their licenses for 6 months. We also awarded all administrators statewide 20 clock hours towards that professional development requirement I talked about for all the work they did transitioning into an online format. Now, they did a lot more than 20 hours, but our board felt that a blanket approval of that is in some recognition of all the extra work that our administrators have had to do. We extended the field experience requirement. So right now in rule, you have 1 year to do your 320 hours of field experience if you want to be an administrator. And universities were saying with all the upheaval that it was harder for them to get those 320 hours in one calendar year. So we've allowed universities to extend that where needed. We also allow online field experience. You can imagine your administrators were doing their field experience in a school and all of a sudden it all went online. And there were some questions to whether we could still count that. We have. Our board said, yeah, if your school that you're working at has moved to online, you can count that towards your field experience. And then finally, I just want to mention, and you can see there, our code of ethics under letter B talks about a school administrator must take reasonable action to protect students and staff from conditions harmful to health and safety. And as you can imagine, what is reasonable action is an interesting debate. And so we've had a noticeable uptick in parents primarily, expressing concern on both sides of the issue. They felt the superintendent was not exercising enough reasonable action to keep their children safe. And then we've had an equal amount on the other side saying they're doing too much and we need to open up. And so it's a constant balancing act for our ethics committee. We have an ethics committee that specializes in this. I'm pleased to say that so far this year, we have been able to mitigate we meaning me, I've been able to work with the parents and the administrators to work this out before it became a formal complaint. And that's always good, because when it becomes formal, the attorney general is involved, and there's a lot of consternation on all sides to try to get that figured out. So far, so good. We've been able to work that out and move forward. Last comment, Mr. Chairman, we're not a typical bureaucracy, and we don't want to be. We regulate when we have to and when the law requires it, and we discipline when the public interest is at stake. But our culture of our board is service. We're problem solvers. We want to help your administrators, help your districts and your legislative districts, help your school districts make it work. And it's because we're all practitioners from the field. So we take great pride in that. And Ms. Chairman, I'd stop there and open up for questions.
Dr. Kinkle, thank you for that. Thank you for your succinctness. Much appreciated. Questions from members? I see Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Kinkle, great to see you. He and I did serve together some years ago. Can you give us the average age of a principal in our school, our schools today? Do you have any idea?
Dr. Kinkle?
Representative Erickson, I don't have that number off the top of my head. I will say that the pipeline seems to be appropriate. As principals are retiring, we're having enough in the pipeline to replace those principals. And Representative Erickson, when you chaired this committee, you may remember when you and I visited about the rule changes, we made two specific rule changes that are increasing the pipeline of administrators. One, we currently require that you must have 3 years of teaching to be an administrator. We broaden that to allow now experiences as a school psychologist, a speech pathologist, a school social worker, and a school psychologist. You can now count those experiences to substitute for teaching. So that's broadened the pipeline a little there. And then the second thing we did is, under the old rules, we only allowed provisional licenses for principals. I.e., if you had a license from Wisconsin, we would give you one in Minnesota and give you 2 years to meet the other standards. Our board broadened that. Now we give provisionals to directors of special ed, where actually there's a little more shortage, and we give provisionals to superintendents. And by far, people from Wisconsin are exercising those opportunities with provisionals. But I do not have the average age. I can get that for you.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Dr. Kinkle. And, you know, our principals have had such a huge responsibility during the pandemic. And in speaking with mine, I've just been so proud of how hard they've worked to bring together all staff and parents, plus the students, you know, to reach some kind of reasonable educational setting. So I salute the school administrators for the work they've done, and thank you for that additional data, because that is very important for us to know. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Dr. Kinkle, Representative Erickson and your presentation sparked a question in my mind. You spoke to the fact that your board is disproportionately female. What's the gender breakdown of administrators in the state? How reflective is your board of that pool?
Mr. Chairman, that is not at all aligned with mm-hmm. administrators. Still tend to be male in all of the fields. We do four licenses: superintendent, principal, director of special ed, and director of community ed for those communities that have 6,000 or more in population. Still disproportionately male. So it's kind of interesting that our board is disproportionately female. I don't know what we can read into that other than maybe work on both ends to do.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, it appears. Dr. Kinkle, thank you very much for joining us today. We'll look forward to having you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, next on our agenda is Dr. Charles Rick, who's the Executive Director of the Pruppert Center for Arts Education, a unique state agency in Minnesota. Dr. Rick, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Charles Rick, Executive Director of the Pruppert Center for Arts Education. Chairman Daphne, I'm going to do a brief overview of the Pruppert Center on the following areas. I'm going to touch on governance, budget, the unique role that Pruppert plays, the impact of COVID on operations and services, and then leave some time for questions and comments. So to begin with, the first couple of slides, I need to tell you right now, I'm having another person change the slide. She's Bethy Anderson, our communications director, and due to some technical difficulties, she is now working on her computer from another location to change these slides for me. So following that, then I guess today's presentation, and change the next two slides show where Pruppert is located. It's located just off Highway 55 and Olson Memorial Highway, as you can see on the map there. And then also the next slide, we have an aerial view of the Pruppert Center. You can see there's the main buildings. There's the main building, there's the Gaia building where we hold other meetings, and then the dorm residence is in the back up in that corner there where the arrow is. And then we have a parking lot as well. Following that then, and regarding governance, Pruppert Center is governed by a board of directors by statute, and we are a state agency dedicated to arts education. The board of directors can have 16 members. 15 members would be from the congressional districts in the state, and there's one ex officio member, which is a commissioner of education, or her designee, and in this case, the designee is Dr. Heather Mueller, serving in that capacity. Along with them representing each congressional district, there has to be at least, should be at least one member, and no member may serve more than two consecutive terms. Also, the Department of Management and Budget, or MMB, provides management services for the Pruppert Center, and one of the areas they work closely with is because employees are all state employees. And then finally, we also work with the Department of Education, as we do have a high school, grades 11 and 12, and we also collaborate on arts education and professional development. Next slide. The next two slides are about regarding our budget. You can see on the slide there the amount that we have as a biennial appropriation. And then finally, we have two charts on this one that shows spending by category, and then also our historical spending. And so we broke that, yeah. Okay, so then it also shows the base appropriation for the upcoming biennium. Next slide. And we have a biennial budget of $17 million, and the funds are primarily from the general fund. And we also receive revenues from student fees and federal reimbursements through the Department of Education, such as special education funds. And you can see the chart how the historical amount of money that Pruppert has received started in 2000 up through 2021. Next slide. This is a picture of our arts. The areas that make up Pruppert, which is the Arts High School, the Public Library, and the PDR, which is a Professional Development Resources Program. Next slide. Unique roles that we play. One is the high school, and they play a unique role of being the state's only residential arts high school. This allows students from all over the state, which is 33 counties out of 87, the opportunity to access a high quality arts infused education. Students At Purpeat, you are immersed in a community of artistically talented and passionate peers. Purpeat is unique in that its college prep program is not only found in academic offerings, but also its artistic skill development and the residential community it provides. Next is our another part, a large part of the Purpeat Center is the professional development and resource programs. And the first bullet there, I think, is important. The goal of PDR is to build teacher and administrator capacity statewide so they can provide innovative, inclusive, standards-based, measurable, and student-centered learning in and through the arts. And you can see right below that the impact that we have statewide in our public schools and the number of students that we have recorded as getting the benefit of that program. So also under the PDR, which I'll go into more detail in the next upcoming slides, we have our art specialists that work with the school districts and MDE. We also have a regional center program. You can see there, and we work through, kind of work with service cooperatives and kind of a hub. And then also we have what's called the Comprehensive Arts Planning Program, CAP, which used to be a program, then it was put aside for a few years, and now we're into the second year of the CAP program being restored. Next slide. And then also, sometimes we call this a three-legged stool. The third leg would be the library. Purpeat Arts Library is a resource for high school students, staff, and the public. It is considered a public library. Any resident can join the library for free and gain access to our extensive art education resources. And there are plenty of them in this building. Also, what we have found is that high school students use the library as a resource for a number of things, including materials, research projects, technology, and study space. Next slide. This is a kind of a graphic that we use that kind of helps put into perspective from a different lens about the Arts High School and what we try to do in there. So in the Arts High School, you can see there that it's very academic and very intensive training in the arts. One, it's a comprehensive tuition-free public school for 11th to 12th graders throughout Minnesota. We offer a rigorous academic program. And the six areas that we focus on are dance, literary arts, media, arts, music, theater, and visual arts. And one of the changes that was made a year ago, so this will be the second year, is there's no cost for qualifying students to live in the residential hall, provided they live 20 miles or more from campus and outside of Hennepin and Ramsey counties. And the way, just a note on the school, the morning is we work off a block schedule, and the students have academic courses in the morning, and then they have their arts studies in the afternoon that oftentimes you'll see students here work in the evening on that as well. Next slide. Regarding professional development and resource programs, otherwise known as PDR, as I mentioned earlier, these are the three different parts that make up PDR. Next slide. We have four art education specialists, and what they do is they serve the work of the Minnesota Fine Arts educators, administrators through dynamic face-to-face and online workshops. They do consultation with the school districts and administrators and teachers, and provide customized professional development to meet school or our district needs. And we have art specialists in the following areas: music, visual and media arts, theater, and dance. And the next slide shows our music specialist. She is Dr. Wendy Barton. She is full-time. Jeremy Holing is a visual and media arts specialist. He is full-time, 1.0. And then our theater specialist is Dr. Stephanie Lee Walther. She is 0.5 FTE. And Mary Harding is our dance specialist, and she is 0.5 in PDR, and she also teaches one of the music teachers and our dance teachers in the high school, which she's 1.0. Next slide. The regional arts Teacher Leader Network program has expanded the last couple years since that I've noticed, and Max Clark Vail is the director. And they have a, and what they do, they work with teachers, art teachers throughout the state, and they're called Rattles. And so they work with Max on in different things regarding the arts and teaching the region. And they can either host a demonstration school event, or there's a lot of consultation that takes place, or up till last March, things that may have occurred here at the Purpose Center. And so that's a program that is continues to grow. And then also our demonstration school, we go out to and target art teachers of same discipline and work with teachers in that school throughout the state as well. It's called demonstration schools. Next slide. As I mentioned earlier, the CAP, or the Comprehensive Arts Plan Program, led by Christy Johnson, is in the, it was put aside a few years ago, and now we, it's a two-year grant that schools receive, and we're working with eight different schools. And what they do is we work with them on planning the comprehensive K-12 school arts education program. And currently we're in the second year of that program. And as I said, we work with eight schools, and we're in the process now of setting the next round as a deadline for schools that are applying is February 1st. Next slide. And again, back to our library. I just would note that we have more than 13,000 items in our library. And you can see the public patrons, how they may use it and how the students may use it. And it's a busy place. Next slide. Now on the impact on our operations, we looked at that, and I broke it down into operations and services that COVID, how it's impacted us. So in terms of some operations, we looked at PPE, with masks and so forth, social distancing, we've worked hard to make that work here at the Purpose Center. Required maintenance and ventilation to improve the air quality and airflow within the buildings. The custodians or the maintenance staff has worked diligently to make that happen. And so the air is turned over every so often. That would help keep the air clean and for us to use. COVID leave is another area through MMB. We've worked with that in terms of people that may be impacted by COVID-19 and different kinds of leave or and so forth. Or they telework from home. And then finally, we spend a fair amount on our technology improvements using the funds that we received. They didn't provide all that much money to here to buy what we did, but now students are one-to-one. We've worked on our other forms of software, our connectivity, we've improved that, and our access within the Purpage buildings themselves. And so that's required us to do that, and I think we've worked hard at that as well. As far as the last three slides I want to show you is the impact on our services, which includes Arts High School, PDR, and the library. Regarding the high school, you can see the different bullets on there, but I'd just like to read something that was from working on closely with the high school principal, which is Con McCartan. He kind of put it in this way. He said, everything that makes Purpose unique is impacted by COVID, as it interferes with our ability to operate as an arts-infused, hands-on school. Our work to interpret MDE guidance in creating our safe learning plan focused on maintaining as much of what makes us unique as possible. Our hybrid model brought students to campus for a week at a time in cohorts organized by our area. This allowed us to maintain a community of like-minded young artists when they were here. Our staff modified their instruction to be able to deliver coursework to both students in front of them and the students who were distance learning when their cohort was not on campus. But cohorts were designed so that the resident students were spread out in their own rooms and bathrooms for the week that they were on campus. Cohorts were also designed so that each class had few enough students to maintain a safe distancing when they were in person for classes. When we had to transition to a distance learning model in November, We implemented a Wellness Wednesday plan where students did not receive direct instruction and used the time to catch up on classwork, connect with teachers for individual help, and participate in programming designed to practice self-care and wellness. Some positives that emerged from the challenges include the following: developing a method for continuing instruction for students who might miss school due to illness, weather, or other challenges they faced from being all over the state. We also addressed an ongoing dilemma of providing access to meetings and performances for those students who live in greater Minnesota and face challenges getting to school on a regular basis. And one other thing that changed also was every month the high school principal had a parent advisory meeting on Tuesday evenings, and they used to be here at the Purpose Center, but when the pandemic hit, we moved them to be online, and we went from having maybe 10 members to anywhere from 50 to 60 to 70 parents on those meetings now. And so now parents, whether they live in close to the Purpose Center or somewhere else in Minnesota, they can participate on those meetings. And I think that's something that was definitely going to stay after this, we end this pandemic. Regarding PDR, after the shift to distance learning in March 2020 due to COVID-19, PDRs were transitioned to an online environment, and they quickly reframed their professional development workshops as virtual experiences, simultaneously worked to curate and disseminate resources for arts educators so they could continue to teach the arts in the most effective way possible. This included creating information and resource hubs on our website, delivering electronic newsletters to statewide arts educators, hosting regular virtual experiences to promote networking and support, break down isolation, share new best practices, working with MDE to edit a guide for art educators in distance learning, and responding quickly to individual requests for support. It seems like during a moment in which the teachers were being asked to fly the plane while building, that actually teaching distance learning while just learning how to do so themselves. So they're doing two things at once. The PDR team provided dedicated support, tools, resources to make this transition easier. Drawing upon the emerging research, their own resources, and their networks across the state, PDR was able to provide support and guidance quickly and seamlessly. And the impact on the library, this is where we did see a decrease. The library is here, but we have seen a decreased numbers of patrons and fewer items being borrowed, loaned out. But overall it's been a decrease, but we're continuing to try new methods to reach out to students and staff and the public. Next slide. And now I will take your questions or comments and just kind of end with this closing statement. Overall, Purpose Center for Arts Education continues to strive for excellence in achieving our mission and vision by the Board of Directors. We are staying focused on art education to better serve our stakeholders.
Thank you, Dr. Rick. Questions from members? Representative Damath.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Rick, for the presentation. A lot of great information. It was good to hear about the Purpose Center. A couple of questions. The total number of students currently being served at the Purpose Center, what would that be?
This year, we have 143 students. I would say when we began in the summer, we were thinking maybe 152, but with the pandemic, we turned out we have 143 students.
Representative Damath, follow up?
Excellent. Do have a follow up? And then again, Dr. Rick, total number of staff currently being employed at the Purpose Center?
Mr. Rick.
I don't have the exact number. I should have that, but I don't. But I'll get that to you. But I know it's, I want to say with teaching staff is like 24. But I can get you that number, total number.
Representative Damath.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Rick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one thing, I would be very interested, if possible, to have a tour at some point of the Purpose Center. I've heard about it, never had the experience. So, Mr. Chair, I don't know if that's something we could do or that has been done in the past, but just to make note that I would be interested in a tour at some point.
It's an intriguing question. I'm not sure how we do that safely in COVID times, but we can certainly put it on the list of aspirations. How's that sound, Representative Davis?
If I may add something to that,
it's correct.
One of the things we created this year too is a virtual tour because we can't have people in like we'd like to. But whenever we can reopen, we would love to have you come and show you around the Purpose Center and what we do and try to accomplish. So,
Dr. Rick, if you could forward the link to the virtual tour, that'd be ideal. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
Representative Jordan.
Chair. And Dr. Rick, I just want to let you know that my partner attended Rich. So he speaks very fondly of his time studying music there. The first question I was going to ask you is what you taught him that makes him think he wants to make guitars, but I'll try to get a better one offline. My question is really around digital arts. I think it's been really interesting to see how there have been live performances or live music classes and the difficulties of that. I'm also thinking about your library and if there are any virtual offerings. Can you talk to me a little bit about what goes into digital? And you touched on this briefly, but how are you teaching, and maybe Representative Sansby can jump in, but how are you teaching children and students how to play music or put on theater performances
in a digital
format? Can you talk
a little bit about that? Like I had a little trouble hearing all the questions. I'll try to just address what I heard. But in terms of how are we teaching? We're teaching, like I said, in the morning they have their academic classes, and then in the afternoon they focus on the arts areas. So they meet in the afternoon with the different arts areas, and it's a lot of hands-on. Learn by doing project-based hands-on, and for an example, for like plays, last year we'd have plays every so often that would be open that they would in the black box, as an example. I think, and I didn't quite catch all your question about the digital part.
Representative Jordan,
yeah,
can
I'm
you
just
restate
wondering
your
how
question?
You're doing this in a, yeah, sorry, my internet is poor. This is a challenge of education that many people are experiencing is access to shoddy internet connections. But Dr. Rick, I was just curious about how you teach arts in a digital format. I think, you know, as you're talking about a hybrid model, we know that arts are extremely hands-on. I did plays in high school. And it's one of those things, I can't imagine trying to rehearse a musical via Zoom. Can you talk a little bit about what you've had to do and what that looks like?
Well, one thing, very, very dedicated staff that work in these areas, and when they can't, they will work with the different students online and so forth. And then about a month or so ago, they did put on a presentation using Zoom. And so they actually practiced, and it was I can get the title of that play for you, but they actually did perform. And so the teachers are working very closely with the students, and especially in the production of theater. And then also in the other areas, like in art, they will work on their art at home, and then we can exchange. They can take pictures of what they're working on and show it to the teachers, or vice versa. And so it's very, so we had to really get better at being able to teach on Google. And so that's the platform we've been using. And so throughout this whole year, the teachers are in constant communication with the students that sometimes extends beyond the normal school day. And one thing that we were doing and we hope to be doing soon again is the way the school was set up this year was to have cohorts, and they divided into three cohort groups. So about 50 students, 40, 50 per group, and they broke them up by their arts areas. And then they would come in for a week at a time and be on task here on site. And then they'd go back home for 2 weeks and continue to get their lessons delivered that way. And then group B would come in the following week, followed by group C. And so we were able to go through two cycles of that until November. And we look forward to when we can start doing that again. So that's how the teachers can keep in contact with the students and vice versa. It works well, as for all things considered this year.
Thank you, Dr. Rick. In the interest of time, members, last question, Representative Kreisha. Representative Kreisha, you're still on mute.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, Dr. Rick. What is your per pupil expense? How much is your per pupil cost?
Dr. Rick?
Yeah, I know we get an appropriation, and in terms of, you know, as I would, I know the total appropriation that we receive and the number of students we have. And that's a difficult question kind of to address at times, because if we compare it to a regular public school, I would have a much better answer for you. But with our appropriation as it is, about $7.2 million per year is what we budget, and that includes everything that we work through. And so I don't know, and so if you divide that out, you'd have to also include like a number of areas into that number. So I don't have an exact number for you. I know we've talked about it on staff, and I've had some other questions, so I'd be more than willing to talk more about that if given some of the different time.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've talked about it. Have you used round numbers? I mean, is it as simple as dividing the 7.2 by the 145 students?
Dr. Rick?
You could do that. And the thing I would just, and that number changes, you know, every year, depending on the number of students we have. And one, you know, by statute, you can have more than 300 students here. We have 143. The numbers have been growing. So the appropriation that we receive is a broad appropriation. And so you could divide that out, but I don't think that's the whole picture without talking more about it.
Sure. Mr. Chair?
Representative Kreisha.
Very good. And just and Dr. Rick, I'm not trying to pin you on it. I just want to get to the object. I mean, we're going to have a very challenging budget ahead of us. And we need to know that number. We need to know how we can objectively put this in the context of what other schools around the state are facing in their per pupil. You know, if the number is 28, rough math, 28 to 32,000 a student, how do we, you know, how do we make sure that we justify that? How do we make sure we make that argument? Because we're going to be making that on the other schools. And the other thing, and this is just a comment, not necessarily in the interest of time, a question, but with the distance learning, and now that you've had to put together a distance learning package and all that, could we look at a model where perhaps we could get the kids back into their own home school districts and do an online delivery? I know you're already doing staff development, but doing an online delivery and maximizing what you've learned through the distance learning for those dollars. Just looking at ways to reach more kids in times of budget constraints. So unless Dr. Rick wants to answer that, he doesn't necessarily need to. It's just a follow-up question. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Mr. Rick, any closing comment?
That's an interesting question to ask, and we'll look into that. We'll talk more about that, and you can get back to us. But overall, I'd just like to say welcome the opportunity to speak with the committee today. And if you have further questions or comments for me or others in the per page, please let me know. You can use my email address or phone number. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Rick. Appreciate your coming before the committee today. Members, we only have about 15 more minutes, which is scant time for the PELSBE, the Minnesota Professional Educators Licensing and Standards Board, to present. So we'll see what Mr. Luigi and Ms. Bailey can provide us. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alex Liuzzi. I'm the Executive Director of the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board. I'll let Elena introduce herself.
And I'm Elena Bailey, the Director of Education Policy at PELSBY.
Great. So we do have quite an extensive slideshow for you that we probably will not be able to process in this time. As a former middle school teacher as well, I feel like you all should get up and have a brain break at this time, but we'll plow forward. Just know that PELSBY is always available to answer any technical questions, to dig deeper into some of the details that you'll see on the screen and the data here. We really do pride ourselves in the outreach that we have to stakeholders in the education community, as well as supporting legislators in the work that they do. So very briefly, PELSBY did start in January 1st of 2018 based on legislative action that combined the Minnesota Board of Teaching with the Educator Licensing Division at the Department of Education. So it took those two sort of departments, if you will, the Board of Teaching and this Educator Licensing Division, made them one, and this became PELSBY in January 1st of 2018. So one important note as we go through this is we are not the Department of Education. We are a separate agency that oversees the role of teachers, but of course we do a lot of work with the Department of Education because those teachers then work in K-12 schools. This is our mission, which is fairly straightforward, and then I will pass it to Elena to go through a few other slides.
Ms. Bailey, please state your name for the record. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Elena Bailey again, the Director of Education Policy, and I will try to be brief here. I just want to give you, in a couple of slides, a sense of PELSBY's jurisdiction and the scope of our work, as well as a brief overview of the tiered system that we're working with. So on this slide, you'll see a picture of kind of the four main areas of PELSBY's jurisdiction. So we have teacher preparation, educator licensure, educator renewal, and educator ethics. One important distinction here is teacher preparation. We name teachers specifically because with kind of one exception, they are all teacher preparation programs where PELSBY, although BOSA has authority over administrators, PELSBY does process administrator licenses as well as related service educators. So school language pathologists, school nurses, psychologists, school social workers. So we have a broader category when it comes to licensure and renewal. I want to bring your attention to on the bottom left corner, you'll see that circle, that number. That's just highlighting for you a sense of the number of dedicated staff that corresponds to some of these numbers we put up here for you. So across the state, we have 35 approved programs that PELSBY oversees, as well those providers, which would be kind of, you know, higher ed institutions, alternative prep providers. And they administer 817 programs across the state. So we have two staff dedicated to working with those groups on compliance improvement, program review, things like that. In terms of educator licensure, Alex will talk in a little bit about the data and why we picked 2019. He mentioned that officially tier licensure rolled out in 2018, but we had some extensions. And of course, last year with COVID, some other changes. So 2019 is the most kind of representative year. So we just wanted to give you a sense and highlights here. You'll see in that year, we had just under 114,000 teachers who held a tier four or tier three license. We issued about 6,000 licenses that year and 3,000 permissions. And that refers to like an out of field permission for someone working outside of their licensure area or an innovative program permission. Educator renewal, you'll get a sense here. We have one staff member working on that, processing 19,000 renewals in 2019. And then finally, educator ethics, we have two staff dedicated there, and they took just 71 actions in 2019. And again, we're happy to dig more into this and give details, but I'm trying to be brief and quick for the sake of time.
Thank you.
So in terms of PELSBY's structure, so our board is an independent board made up of volunteers, and it is 11-member board, although we do have a couple open positions, so we're working with a slightly smaller group right now. And they are responsible for all the work I just mentioned on the other screen in terms of jurisdiction. So that involves a lot of, you know, committee work and things like that, but that also means delegating to our small agency, which is a staff of 22 people, to do those day-to-day operations. And just so you get a sense of our structure, we have, you know, Alex as our executive director, then you have two managers working at PELSBY, our licensing and operations manager, and then myself. and we oversee respective departments, but we, you know, it's a small agency, so we're working across a lot of different things. So to give you just a sense of everything, we've grouped it into kind of three areas. We have about 11 staff that work in licensing and operations, 5 that work in board support, and that includes everything from communications to ethics to rulemaking, and then 3 staff that work in teacher prep and policy, which includes data and compliance as well. One thing I do want to make sure you're aware of, again, small agency, 22 people, we don't have an HR or a finance department, so we rely on the Department of Administration to do all of that work. Similarly, you probably know in 2019, Pelsby was given the task of administering 2 new grants, the Collaborative Urban Educators of Color, Urban and Greater Minnesota, excuse me, let me not forget Greater Minnesota, Educators of Color Grant and the Teacher Mentorship Grant. And so we also relied on the Department of Administration, as well as a partnership with the Office of Higher Education to do that work. We temporarily had a grant specialist for 18 months, but again, that was a temporary position. So just wanted to give you a sense of kind of as work grows, it often involves relying and working with some of these other agencies on those projects. And then the last thing I will mention before turning it back to Alex is just a picture here of tier licensure. I'm not going to go through all of this. We really just want to highlight a couple of key things or differences for you. One being kind of the key difference between a tier 1 and tier 2 license and a tier 3 and tier 4 license. So tier 1 and tier 2, that individual is tied to a specific district and it requires a job offer for that individual. Where a tier 3 or tier 4 license, that individual can use that in any district and move around. So they don't need a job offer and it's not tied to any specific district. You'll also notice that tier 3 and 4 are unlimited in the renewal, whereas tier 1 and 2, there is a limit of 3 with good cause exemption, of course. There's some other notable differences in terms of requirements, but again, it's kind of beyond our time here. So we're more than happy to dig into this further and answer any questions you may have. So with that, I will turn it back to Alex.
Thank you, Elena. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do give hour-long presentations on tier licensure, so if anyone is interested in digging more into those details, we're happy to do it. We do a lot of data at our agency, and we have a tiered licensure report that comes out annually. It was presented to the board in December, and we have a supply and demand report that will be published tomorrow. That is the biannual teacher supply and demand report. So this is just a snapshot of that data, but we do recommend going deeper into those reports. The links are on our website, and of course, those reports will be sent out to legislators as well. The Teachers Supply and Demand report will be. Just a quick overview of our full year of tiered licensure data. I want to highlight just 3 different pieces here. One is there's still a lot of conversations about tier 1 and tier 2, but it is important to note that still over 90% of our teachers in Minnesota are tier 4 teachers. So we highlight sort of how do we provide more access to and support for districts in that tier one and tier 2 areas. And it's still a pretty low percentage of the amount of teachers that are teaching in Minnesota. When we break that up by district type, you can see that charter schools have a much higher reliance as a proportion of their teachers on tier 1, tier 2, and tier 3 teachers. And we do talk about in the supply and demand report how that probably could use some legislative conversations about what are policies to support teachers within charter schools that might help them move up to that tier 3 and tier 4 license. Additionally, when you break the data out by economic development region, and here just on this graphic, we combined the regions for Greater Minnesota, but it's true also if you split them up by economic development region, there's very little difference in the proportion of teachers on each tier within across Minnesota. So when we think about the supply and demand in Minnesota, it's pretty evenly spread out between economic development regions and metro versus Greater Minnesota. Next slide, please. We also break this data down by race and ethnicity as we, the board and, you know, follows what the legislature has as a priority also of increasing teachers of color and indigenous teachers in the state. So here's a lot of data for this. Again, the tiered licensure report breaks this down into raw numbers and combines data and analyzes it. The teacher supply and demand report will do that as well. But there's a couple important things to highlight here. One is our data sources are varied in how we collect this, and it does appear that the districts who report this data, we get a lot of this data from districts, have changed the way that they have identified the race and ethnicity of some of their teachers, which has skewed some of our data and changes it from our last supply and demand report. So we're trying to analyze that at this point. Additionally, we receive, since the beginning of tiered licensure, race and ethnicity data optionally provided by someone who is applying for the license. They are not required to provide their race and ethnicity on that application. And so we do have a high percentage of people, specifically you'll note in that tier three bucket, those are new new teachers who have not identified their race and ethnicity. And we need to talk about ways where we can still have those conversations, but without making that a required piece on the application. So lots of stuff to dig into there, but for time, we will move on to the next slide. Quickly, our operations at this point, our budget for the fiscal year 21, you'll see that the majority of our allocations are related to staff, but we also do have a significant amount of operations because we do contract with the Department of Admin for our HR and finance services. We have a big minute budget because of the amount of projects that go with minute, and we just plop there right at the bottom of it that, again, the two grants are separate from this allocation, that grant money that we receive, and 100% of it goes out to individuals that apply for those grants. We did have, in both those grants, a much higher request for funds than we were able to give out, which is, I think, important noting policy conversations as well. The next slide, you'll note that our total revenue based on these three different areas is far lower than what we receive in our budget. And we continue to have conversations, and you'll see it in our policy proposals this year, that $57 application fee that the state takes in, all of this goes to the general fund, by the way, hasn't changed in 15 years. So we recommend an increase into that fee so that $2.7 million that we receive and this $1.6 million that we take in as revenue could be more aligned in the future. And moving on to the next slide, just quickly what we've done for in the time of COVID, we have had 11 emergency board meetings so that we can quickly address any needs that districts have, teachers have. We provide a lot of discretionary variances during this time of board rule to allow more flexibility. We've had 7 information sessions. We have another one this Friday where we invite anyone who would like to come and learn about some of these pieces or just ask other questions about what they can be doing in this time to provide up-to-date information. But a key piece here I think that's important to focus on is the out-of-field permission. This is a licensed teacher being able to teach out of their field. We waive the requirement that a district has to post for this position so that districts can be much more flexible in taking their licensed teachers and allowing them to fill in other positions when they have shortage areas. But of course, there's many other pieces here we could dig into if we had more time. And I believe that is all of our slides. We're happy to entertain questions. And of course, we're happy to come back and to dig into any of this at any other time as well.
Mr. Luisi, Ms. Bailey, that was remarkable. Bringing it in just under the wire with all the slides. So we're going to have to invite you back at another time. I'm sure there will be opportunity. Appreciated the breadth of your presentation as well as the speed and dexterity. Members, I see one question from Representative Feist, but it needs to be extremely brief. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, in light of the fact that there have been a severe shortage in substitute teachers, have you considered lowering the requirements from a bachelor's degree to an associate's or perhaps relevant college credit?
Mr. Luisi?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We have lots of ideas, but there is the purview that the board has within administrative rule is actually fairly limited. Most of the pieces about licensure are within statute, so those are statutory requirements. We did have conversations with legislators over the summer about possible legislation moving forward, but during one of the special sessions, but of course we don't have the authority to bring legislation to you. That's your job. So we would, of course, be open to technical conversations about what a bill like that could look like, what the impact would be, but we leave that open to legislators to decide if that's a good decision or not.
Thank you very much. Members, with that, our time has come to an end for today. We will convene again same time tomorrow. Thanks to all of the presenters today for your informative presentations. Members, thank you for your good questions. With that, we are adjourned.